If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore his seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In 1701, a wealthy young widow named Dame Mary Grosvenor woke up in a room at the Hotel Castile in Paris and found a strange man in her bed. The heiress to a huge London estate, she'd struggled with bouts of unstable behaviour and may have been ensnared by a pair of opportunistic brothers eager to capitalise on the plight of a grieving woman. A new book, Inheritance, The Lost History of Mary Davies, tells the unexpected story of what happened to Mary and the strange, scandalous court case that followed. Our sub-editor, Rhiannon Davies, was joined by its author, Leo Hollis.
So Leo, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're here to talk about your new book, Inheritance. So I thought that a great place to start would be for you to tell us, what is The Inheritance? Why that for the title of the book?
Well, The Inheritance is a plot of land. The main character, if you like, in the book is a woman called Mary Davies. Now, she's often mentioned in sort of histories of London, but she's often mentioned for unexpected reasons. One of the stories that many historians have told is the fact that she married at the age of 12. She was a very young heiress, she was married off to a man called Sir Thomas Grosvenor while still a teenager. And the stories then continue, and the end result of that marriage is the development of Mayfair and Grosvenor Square and some of the most important developments in early 18th century London. However, I discovered that there was another story about Mary, a story that has been overlooked and I felt was rich and fascinating and needed to be told. And this is what The Inheritance is. So The Inheritance is the land, but it's also Mary herself.
And before we come on to Mary's story in more detail, one of the parts of your book that I really enjoy is you really give such an amazing view of what London is like and how it's changing as a city. It's this period of huge growth and change at the time. Can you tell me how the city is changing in the 17th century?
So I'm fascinated by 17th century London, particularly that period after the Civil War. So Restoration London all the way up to the beginning of the 18th century. This is a well-known area of plague, of fire, of the rebuilding, and, you know, of icons such as St. Paul's Cathedral. In my previous book, which is a book called The Phoenix, I looked at how London was rebuilt during that period. And it is really the moment, in my opinion at least, that London became the first modern city. It totally transformed not just the way that a city looked, but the way that it worked, the way that people lived in it. And so in many ways, The Inheritance is a book that covers in some ways the same period, but it does it through a completely different lens. So you think that the sort of city is growing massively after the Great Fire. It is growing beyond the burnt neighbourhoods into new suburbs. So the what were then sort of suburbs, farmland that was being turned into these new neighbourhoods, and a different type of housing and a different way of living was being developed in these new plots. So you saw the rise of the terraced house, as well as a new kind of domestic arrangements. And so London becomes this massive city from having been quite a sort of European backwater. And it's also, at the same time, you get a sort of change within the sort of social structure of the city. It becomes less a royal city and more a city that is dominated by the merchant classes. And this, again, is reflected in the way that the city develops. So it's a period of extraordinary change. We haven't seen sort of change on this scale until perhaps the 19th century, when again it expanded massively. And that's why I find it so extraordinarily fascinating.
So you mentioned plague and the Fire of London, and these both have a huge impact on the city. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yes, I mean, they are some of the sort of most dramatic but also important events that happened within the sort of Restoration city. So the plague in 1665, which emerges first in the kind of the sort of slightly slum areas just on the edge of the city, but very quickly over the course of that summer, feed through the rest of the city. The human impact of the plague, I think, is often sort of forgotten, that one in three Londoners were sort of cut down by this disease. It also had, I think, a huge social impact in that, you know, it was a disease that, in the main, attacked the poor, because on one hand, the rich just disappeared. They left and went to their estates. And so, in some ways, the poor were abandoned within the city. There was very little that the sort of medical or the religious community could do to combat this disease. They didn't know where it came from. And so, in some ways, the virus totally transformed the sort of social fabric of the city. The fire, which occurred in September 1666, so sort of little under a year later, transformed the physical fabric of the city. So the burnt area of the city had to be rebuilt. And it's my argument that the fire was, in some ways, the sort of transformative moment within this period in terms of what it did to the physical organization of the city. But it also transformed the way that, you know, householding and ownership was defined. It redefined what should be built and how it should be built. It also transformed the construction business that was then, by, you know, 10, 15 years later, would then go and build the suburbs that became Soho and Bloomsbury and, you know, the outer reaches of the city, and started in some ways, those sort of metropolitan rings around the city that in some ways sort of still continue today. It changed the way that people, you know, the kind of houses that were being built and how they were being built. And it also, perhaps the most invisible impact was the way that it was being paid for. So, you know, finance, banking, the development of leaseholds and mortgages are as important as, you know, the development of, you know, the technologies of construction.
And as well as changing physically, there's also changing ideas. And one in particular is to do with this idea of private property. Now, that's a phrase that a 21st century listener is very familiar with. But in the year 1700, what did it mean to own something?
Well, this is a sort of a fascinating question. As we assume that private property is something that has in some ways always existed, that it has been the way that we have dealt with land and with property for hundreds and hundreds of years. But what my book tries to show is that this has a history. It has a moment when a private property was sort of formed as an idea and then became absolutely central to what a city was and to what the nation was. And so this happens in terms of law. It happens then in terms of the way that sort of social relations change. So, you know, my book looks at an heiress and how her relationship with the land is changed. So in many ways, her body and her inheritance, the plot of land that she owns, become one and the same. So private property is this thing that we assume has always been around. But to unpack that and to sort of see it as contingent, I think totally transforms the way that we look at the city.
And coming on now to look at the heiress, to look at Mary in more detail, how does her land come to be her inheritance? How does it pass down to her?
Well, the land was originally bought by a financier, a man called Hugh Audley, who bought it in 1619. And on his death in 1662, he hands it on to somebody who works in his office, who's also a family relation, a man called Alexander Davies, who starts developing part of the land and turning it into a sort of new housing sort of scheme down by Horse Ferry, so very close to Westminster. However, he dies in the Great Plague in 1665, leaving everything to his six-month-old baby, Mary. And so as a babe, she inherits this extraordinary sort of swathe of land that goes all the way from the Thames up to what was then Tyburn or Oxford Street. So at the time of the inheritance, it was outside, as it were, the development of the city. But over the course of her life, her land became more and more valuable until at the end, it was then right on the edge of the city.
And how does her gender affect her inheritance?
In every single way. I mean, if Mary had been a baby boy, there wouldn't be a story to tell, almost. But on every single level, the fact that Mary was born a daughter in some ways determines almost every moment of her life afterwards. So very quickly, she becomes a commodity on the marriage market of London, her mother does a deal when she's 10 first with a Lord Berkeley. That deal falls through, but 2 years later, she is then brought to the altar at St. Clement's Danes and marries Sir Thomas Grosvenor. At that moment, her inheritance becomes Sir Thomas's property. And she has, as it were, sort of nothing but a wife's rights to his property. And that is the way that it continues until he dies in 1700. And then the property, in some ways, returns back to Mary. And that is when the drama that we'll get onto occurs.
And this is something that I want to talk about is widowhood. Mary's mother loses her husband and Mary loses her husband as well. But in the 17th century, being a widow did have benefits, didn't it? What could you do as a woman if you were a widow?
Well, you could own property. I mean, the laws of couverture sort of existed for the marriage period, but an unmarried woman and a widow had legal rights as property owners. They had, in some ways, direct ownership of what was then called the widow's third, or a portion. So they had at least a third of the estate under their own name in order to sort of help them survive their own widowhood. There was also a jointure, so an annual income that was guaranteed, usually as part of the sort of marriage negotiations. But if you think that the cultural and the historical sort of position of the widow, often they were sort of portrayed as people who were sort of fascinated in property and maintaining the estate. And so you see in lots of restoration dramas a kind of a widow as a comic character who is desperately accumulating and preserving their wealth and fortune. Or a widow is somebody who's vulnerable. So somebody who is the prey of predatory young men or people in search of a new fortune.
So rewinding slightly here, so while Thomas Grosvenor is still alive, Mary makes a very monumental decision and she converts to Roman Catholicism. Why was this such a contentious decision to make at this time?
So I think the thing to know about sort of Mary is that she marries at 12 and she stays in London for 3 years until she is 15, so until her age of consent. And then she moves up to go and live with Sir Thomas Grosvenor in their new estate, Eaton Hall, just outside Chester. During this period, and they're married for something like 15 years, there is almost no evidence of sort of Mary's day-to-day life. We don't know what's going on inside her head. We can only guess through the report of others, you know, how she's dealing with being a wife, being a mother, you know, being a mistress of a huge estate. There is this account that perhaps in her sort of late teens, early 20s, just before James II takes the throne, Mary converts to Catholicism. And this is a hugely monumental decision, particularly for such a young woman to make on her own. It goes against her family. Back in London, her grandfather was a sort of leading Anglican vicar. It goes against her husband, who also has a sort of prominent public role as a kind of local grandee and a sort of staunch Protestant. So this decision seems almost like sort of lightning out of the blue, and it's very, very difficult to sort of work out why she did it, but one gets a sort of sense of a young woman trying to find her place in the world. And so, you know, who is she talking to? What communities has welcomed her into Chester? And you can sort of see that there are connections and there are Catholic families around Chester who have welcomed her. And within the sort of debates of the period, you know, Catholicism, despite the fact that it is a persecuted religion, also has sort of huge attractions to a young woman. There are rituals and there are different ways of living that perhaps allow a woman to have sort of a different sort of social role. And so it's, one has to sort of, in some ways, sort of read the smoke signals rather than actually sort of be able to read any document. But it is revealing, and I think what it does show about Mary is a sort of strength of character. And once she has made this decision, she sticks with it. And you know, in many ways, that is the most revealing thing about her during this period.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
what is revealed is the doctor stands in the dock and sort of says, actually, I never saw Mary. I was only told about her condition, and yet I still prescribed the laudanum and the bleeding.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And there's a figure that she meets as her decision to convert who is called Lodewyck Fenwick. Can you tell us who he was?
So after she converted to Catholicism, Mary and her husband, Sir Thomas, in some ways they have to negotiate how to deal with this issue. So it's decided that the children will remain Protestant. However, Mary will be allowed to conduct certain sort of Catholic masses and rituals in the family home as long as it's done quietly. So it is at some point during this period, she hires a chaplain. So in some ways, a sort of a personal confessor who is a Benedictine monk, a British Benedictine monk called Lodewyck Fenwick. And we hope and we assume that, he works closely with her. He's a sort of confidant. He is a spiritual advisor to her. But his role in the family overall and, his position within the sort of the wider sort of state is never clearly explained. What does become apparent is when Sir Thomas dies in 1700, so when Mary is around 35, Lodewyck Fenwick becomes incredibly influential and takes Mary under his wing, and they start planning a journey away from England.
And we'll be coming onto that journey in just a moment. Before we discuss that and what happens next, there's a really big theme of your book that I wanted to ask you a few questions about, which is madness. In this period, there's an increasing focus on rationalism and reason, but there's also a focus on the opposite of that, unreason and madness. How do attitudes towards madness change in England in Mary's lifetime?
So there is a later accusation that Mary might be mad, and we will go on to explain why that is pertinent to her life story. What's really interesting is setting those accusations within the sort of wider context of sanity or insanity, or where the unsane sort of lived and worked within sort of English society at that time. Much of the debates and most of the history that we have about this is very influenced by the work of Michel Foucault, the French sort of historian and post-structural thinker, who makes an argument that from this period, what we see is a great confinement, which is that we sort of see the start of the mad being separated and othered from the sane society and put into asylums or, you know, excised from everyday life. Foucault's argument is highly contentious, and in many ways the evidence doesn't stack up, at least for the British example. You know, there weren't asylums until the 18th sort of century, apart from, you know, charitable organisations like Bedlam. Instead, what you have is, on the one hand, you have this scientific revolution, which is highlighting the importance of reason as the core of human sort of genius, and on the other hand, you have this transformation of you know, the mad or the unsocial as a sort of, in some ways, a kind of sort of social class. This is still being looked after by the community. So, you know, if a person was considered to be unfit or, you know, in need of help, that help usually came from the parish or from a sort of a local charitable organisation. This is changing somewhat, but still, one is in some ways defined by not by one's madness, but what by one's ability to look after oneself. I think the other thing that is going on is, you know, in the pre-Civil War period, the emphasis was very much on sort of questions of melancholia. And you have Richard Burton's very famous book from the 1620s, which is trying to anatomize what melancholia is as the sort of key form of madness and where it comes from. And if anyone has a chance to read The Anatomy of Melancholia, it is extraordinary the range of stimuli that Burton looks at. But again, this is somewhat sort of changing over this period, and people are starting to sort of think, is madness in the brain? And if so, should we be cutting into the brain and seeing how it works? Alternatively, there are other people sort of saying, well, should we be looking at other parts of the body as the source of this sort of imbalance, if you like? And people start looking at nerves and other kinds of forms of sort of anatomy as an explanation of behavior. And then I think as a sort of a final strand that is coming through here is the sort of question of gender. You know, in the 17th century it was mostly men who were sort of condemned to be sort of mad or were considered to be mad. But slowly through the 18th century, it becomes increasingly a female malady, if you like. And that is a significant change. Obviously, all interpretations of madness during this time come through people looking at the afflicted. It's very rare that you actually get accounts from the people who are feeling either melancholia or mania, and explaining their behaviour. So there is always going to be this idea that madness is perceived. It's never actually, you know, a personal explanation, and that's going to become crucial when it comes to the sort of the legal debates over whether Mary was mad or not in her life.
And what episodes in Mary's life did people perceive to be madness?
Well, I think there are a number of accounts that comes out in a later court case in which, on one occasion, she tried to escape from the estate, from Eaton Hall, and she had to be picked up and brought back into the house by Sir Thomas. And then that evening, she tries to throw herself out of a window. And as a result, she is given a nurse, and someone actually sort of sits outside the window to make sure that she doesn't attempt her escape again. On another occasion, she started to sort of see phantoms and witches in her bedroom. In another occasion, she's decided to break all the china in the house. And then there's another tragic sort of account that comes when somebody goes to visit her, and she just sits in the room sort of weeping and just shredding her clothes. And you can interpret this because this is something that has sort of been seen to be one of the signatures of a particular kind of sort of bipolar sort of condition. However, it's impossible to really define her madness, because it always comes through other people's eyes, and it always comes from a distance of sort of 300 years or so. She could be grieving. She lost two sons during this period, despite what many historians sort of say about a parent's love for their young children, she could have felt this deeply. She could also be feeling, incredibly impotent as a young woman, sort of stuck in a situation that is outside her control. There are so many other ways of trying to sort of think this through that to call it just mania or just madness, I think is perhaps too prescriptive.
And after the death of Sir Thomas, when she travels to the continent with the priest Fenwick, what happens when she reaches the continent?
So this is in many ways the part of the story which I think is absolutely central to the book, but it's also the bit that's left out of all the other history books. This is the lost history I think is the true heart of her story. So she becomes a widow, and she decides very quickly with Fenwick that they would go travelling to Europe. In particular, they would go to Paris, perhaps to see the exiled James II, we don't know, and then on to Rome, where there was a jubilee, which was a particular sort of event that was organised by the papacy, and it was an opportunity to get some kind of sort of benediction from the Pope. So they head off. Lodvick, two or three sort of servants, and they start off from their London house, and they move first to Paris, and then they move to Rome. And in Rome, Mary starts to be a little bit ill, so they decide to travel back. They stop off in Lyon, where they have to have a break because Mary is feeling incredibly ill. And there they, a doctor prescribes bleeding and certain sort of potions. And once she has recovered a certain amount of her spirits, they finally make it to Paris on the 12th of June, 1701. And they book into the Hotel Castile. And over the next week, day by day, there are an extraordinary sequence of events which would become the central sort of focus of the later court case. So she arrives on that Sunday. On Monday, she rests. There is, people, try and visit her. Her servants and Lodvick Fenwick start to ask around to see whether there is a doctor who could help her as part of the sort of the English community in Paris. On Tuesday, she is prescribed an emetic, so a purgative, in order to force her to vomit out the sort of fever. She is given such a huge dose that the landlady of the hotel gets extremely frightened, and she's then prescribed something to, as it were, sort of combat that purging. On the next day, which is a Wednesday, she is prescribed opium. She is frightened about having another purgative. Mary refuses sort of any food during that day, and so it's not until the next day that the opium is actually given to her. It's first sprinkled upon a pair of poached eggs, and so she doesn't know that she's being dosed in this way. And then later on, what the servants do is they get a bowl of strawberries and they take out the stalks of the strawberries and they put a little bit of opium into the flesh of the strawberry and put the stalks back in and then present Mary with the plate of strawberries. So she is being drugged against her knowledge. During this week also, she has been reacquainted with Lodwick Fenwick's brother, a man called Edward Fenwick, who she had met twice before as they prepared for their journey in England. And he was there on the departure party in London. And he thought that he had made a connection with Mary. And so he had pursued her to Paris. And in some ways, their friendship was rekindled during this week. By Friday, she's feeling extremely weak, and she is given another dose of laudanum, and she's also bled on her feet. So again, her body is made much weaker. On Saturday morning, she wakes up and she finds Edward Fenwick in her bed, and within 3 or 4 hours, so before lunchtime, they're married. They're married by Lodwick in the bedroom, with two servants as their witnesses. This is, in some ways, the sort of marriage, or the sort of supposed marriage, that then becomes the crisis of the rest of the narrative of the book.
I found the description of their vows so harrowing when she talks so quietly and says, "But that's how I married Sir Thomas," with such a quiet voice. It was a really affecting read. One question I had is about the treatments, and I say that in quotation marks, that she's given. Were these like normal treatments for the time? Was it normal for people to not know that they were being treated for these kind of maladies?
Well, these become the sort of the debate points in the court case, which occurs 2 years later. So what happens is, 3 weeks later, Mary rushes back to London and denies the marriage had ever occurred. And Edward follows on, claiming and demanding his conjugal rights, and also starting to treat Mary's inheritance as his own property. So he has now become the owner of the estate, and he starts demanding rents from tenants and threatening evictions. So this builds up to a massive court case, which occurs in April 1703, in which the specifics of what happened in that hotel room and what happened over the course of that week becomes the legal debates and the source of witness statements and in some ways sort of counter arguments from the prosecution and the defence. So what is revealed is the doctor stands in the dock and sort of says, "Actually, I never saw Mary. I was only told about her condition. And yet I still prescribed the laudanum and the bleeding," which sounds extraordinary. He then sort of gives his excuses. This is what you would do if it were a child. He is then asked, how did he know how much she was being dosed? And he sort of said, "I suspect the doses that were given were not so high that it would have made her deranged." But then again, the defence, on the other hand, would argue that she was drugged and she was poisoned and she was bled, and as a result, she was no longer in control of her faculties.
Mm. And this court case that you're talking about, this is the Queen's Bench, which is the highest court in the land. What's the outcome?
Well, I mean, there is this verbatim account of the trial, which is part of the Grosvenor Estate sort of archive. And so you can sit down and you can read over the sort of course of the 14 hours of the deliberations and the sort of statements. And it's one of the most exciting pieces of sort of archival research I've ever done. It's just thrilling to hear the argument and the counter-argument and that kind of thing. Then the presiding judge, Chief Justice Holt, sums up the case, and so, you know, he sort of turns to the jury and he sort of says, these are the important facts. They took half an hour to decide whether the wedding had been legitimate, and they decided at 4 o'clock in the morning on April the 4th that it had been a legitimate marriage, which means that the Grosvenor family lost their estate, and the estate was handed over to the Fenwicks. However, that's not exactly what happened in the end. The fact that it's called Grosvenor Square rather than Fenwick Square probably, is evidence enough that in the end there is another court case that occurs 2 years after the Queen's Bench at the Court of Delegates, which reverses the decision that was made by that jury. The Court of Delegates, in some ways, is a sort of appeal court, which is made up of judges and bishops, and is far more involved in questions of the legitimacy of the marriage rather than the sort of the question of property. But obviously, one was connected with the other. So the Court of Delegates finally decide that the marriage was illegitimate, and Fenwick loses his right to the estate. And then within a matter of weeks, Mary was legally defined as a lunatic by her family. And as a result, she lost her rights to her property, which was then put into the hands of guardians on behalf of her children. And she spends the last 25 years of her life a long way from her estate, living under the sort of protection of her guardians.
And my final question is, other historians have discussed Mary's life, but never to the extent that you've gone to. What was it about this story, this case, that captured your attention and made you need to find out more?
I think there is a human element to it, which I just found so incredibly compelling. The narrative, if you like, is fascinating. But it's through that narrative that so many things that sort of interest me about that sort of period comes to rest, and is sort of brought into light. Such things as the development of London itself, that the idea of property. I felt also that very strongly that wanting to sort of think about questions of madness and questions of property, and also questions of sort of religion and how those sort of fit in, and in some ways, Mary is a fascinating character in that she's the kind of person who is often ignored. I still think that there's plenty of work to be done in uncovering lives like Mary's, both of her class, but also the fact that so much of her life is shrouded in silence doesn't mean that she was silent. And I wanted to sort of try and see what I could hear by going through the archives, going through the land contracts, going through the wider contexts in which she lived. Because, you know, we are still at this moment in which we're trying to decide whose stories should be told. And you know, I think Mary was, on the one hand, an incredibly privileged woman, but I think on the other hand, there are other things that come out and are drawn out through her life, which tell us so much about that period, and also, you know, the injustices that still continue.
That was Leo Hollis. His new book, Inheritance, The Lost History of Mary Davies, A Story of Property, Marriage and Madness, is out now, published by One World. You can find a link in the episode description. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow for the next episode in our series on Britain's greatest prime ministers.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.